Part 2 of Chapter 5 of John Brown by W. E. Burkhart Du Bois. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. The first National Negro leader, Frederick Douglass, had delivered his wonderful salutatory to New Bedford in 1844. After publishing his biography, he went to England for safety, but returned in 1847, ransomed from slavery, and ready to launch his paper, The North Star. No sooner had he landed than the black wise men of New York told him of the new star in the east, whispering of the strange, determined man of Springfield, who flitted silently here and there among the groups of black folk, and whose life was devoted to eternal war upon slavery. Both were eager to meet each other, John Brown to become acquainted with the greatest leader of the race which he aimed to free, Frederick Douglass to know an intense foe of slavery. The historic meeting took place in Springfield, and is best told in Douglass's own words. About the time I began my enterprise, i.e. his newspaper, in Rochester, I chanced to spend a night and a day under the roof of a man whose character and conversation, and whose objects and aims in life, made a very deep impression upon my mind and heart. His name had been mentioned to me by several prominent colored men, among whom were the Reverend Henry Highland Garnet and J.W. Logan. In speaking of him, their voices would drop to a whisper, and what they said of him made me very eager to see and to know him. Fortunately, I was invited to see him at his own house. At the time to which I now refer, this man was a respectable merchant in a populous and thriving city, and our first place of meeting was at his store. This was a substantial brick building on a prominent, busy street. A glance at the interior, as well as the massive walls without, gave me the impression that the owner must be a man of considerable wealth. My welcome was all that I could have asked. Every member of the family, young and old, seemed glad to see me, and I was made much at home in a very little while. I was, however, a little disappointed with the appearance of the house and its location. After seeing the fine store, I was prepared to see a fine residence in an eligible locality, but this conclusion was completely dispelled by actual observation. In fact, the house was neither commodious nor elegant, nor its situation desirable. It was a small wooden building on a back street in a neighborhood chiefly occupied by laboring men and mechanics. Respectable enough, to be sure, but not quite the place, I thought, where one would look for the residence of a flourishing and successful merchant. Plain as was the outside of this man's house, the inside was plainer. Its furniture would have satisfied a Spartan. It would take longer to tell what was not in this house than what was in it. There was an air of plainness about it which almost suggested destitution. My first meal passed under the misnomer of tea, though there was nothing about it resembling the usual significance of that term. It consisted of beef soup, cabbage, and potatoes, a meal such as a man might relish after following the plow all day or performing a forced march of a dozen miles over a rough road in frosty weather. Innocent of paint, veneering, varnish, or tablecloth, the table announced itself unmistakably of pine and of the plainest workmanship. There was no hired help visible. The mother, daughters, and sons did the serving, and did it well. They were evidently used to it, and had no thought of any impropriety or degradation in being their own servants. It is said that a house in some measure reflects the character of its occupants. This one certainly did. In it there were no disguises, no illusions, no make-believes. Everything implied stern truth, solid purpose, and rigid economy. I was not long in company with the master of this house before I discovered that he was indeed the master of it, and was likely to become mine too if I stayed long enough with him. His wife believed in him, and his children observed him with reverence. Whenever he spoke, his words commanded earnest attention. His arguments, which I ventured at some points to oppose, seemed to convince all. His appeals touched all, and his will impressed all. Certainly, I never felt myself in the presence of a stronger religious influence than while in this man's house. In person, he was lean, strong, and sinewy, of the best New England mold, built for times of trouble and fitted to grapple with the flintiest hardships. Clad in plain American woolen, shod in boots of cowhide leather, and wearing a cravat of the same substantial material, under 6 feet high, less than 150 pounds in weight, aged about 50, he presented a figure straight and symmetrical as a mountain pine. His bearing was singularly impressive. His head was not large, but compact and high. His hair was coarse, strong, slightly gray, and closely trimmed, and grew low on his forehead. His face was smoothly shaved and revealed a strong, square mouth, supported by a broad and prominent chin. His eyes were bluish-gray, and in conversation they were full of light and fire. When on the street, he moved with a long, springing racehorse step, absorbed by his own reflections, neither seeking nor shunning observation. Such was the man whose name I had heard in whispers. Such was the spirit of his house and family. Such was the house in which he lived. And such was Captain John Brown, whose name has now passed into history as that of one of the most marked characters and greatest heroes known to American fame. After the strong meal already described, Captain Brown cautiously approached the subject which he wished to bring to my attention, for he seemed to apprehend opposition to his views. He denounced slavery in look and language fierce and bitter, thought that slaveholders had forfeited their right to live, that the slaves had the right to gain their liberty in any way they could, did not believe that moral suasion would ever liberate the slave, or that political action would abolish the system. He said that he had long had a plan which could accomplish this end, and he had invited me to his house to lay that plan before me. He said he had been for some time looking for colored men to whom he could safely reveal his secret, and at times he had almost despaired of finding such men, but that now he was encouraged, for he saw heads of such men rising up in all directions. He had observed my course at home and abroad, and he wanted my cooperation. His plan as it then lay in his mind had much to commend it. It did not, as some suppose, contemplate a general rising among the slaves, and a general slaughter of the slave masters. An insurrection, he thought, would only defeat the object. But his plan did contemplate the creating of an armed force which should act in the very heart of the South. He was not averse to the shedding of blood, and thought the practice of carrying arms would be a good one for the colored people to adopt, as it would give them a sense of their manhood. No people, he said, could have self-respect or be respected who would not fight for their freedom. He called my attention to a map of the United States, and pointed out to me the far-reaching Alleghenies, which stretch away from the borders of New York into the southern states. These mountains, he said, are the basis of my plan. God has given the strength of the hills to freedom. They were placed here for the emancipation of the Negro race. They are full of natural forts, where one man for defense will be equal to 100 for attack. They are full also of good hiding places, where large numbers of brave men could be concealed, and baffle and elude pursuit for a long time. I know these mountains well, and could take a body of men into them and keep them there despite of all efforts of Virginia to dislodge them. The true object to be sought is first of all to destroy the money value of slavery property, and that can only be done by rendering such property insecure. My plan, then, is to take at first about 25 picked men and begin on a small scale, supply them with arms and ammunition, and post them in squads of fives on a line of 25 miles. The most persuasive and judicious of these shall go down to the fields from time to time, as opportunity offers, and induce the slaves to join them, seeking and selecting the most restless and daring. He saw that in this part of the work, the utmost care must be used to avoid treachery and disclosure. Only the most conscientious and skillful should be sent on this perilous duty. With care and enterprise, he thought he could soon gather a force of 100 hardy men, men who would be content to lead the free and adventurous life to which he proposed to train them. When these were properly drilled and each man had found the place for which he was best suited, they would begin work in earnest. They would run off the slaves in large numbers, retain the brave and strong ones in the mountains, and send the weak and timid to the north by the Underground Railroad. His operations would be enlarged with increasing numbers and would not be confined to one locality. When I asked him how he would support these men, he said emphatically that he would subsist them upon the enemy. Slavery was a state of war, and the slave had a right to anything necessary to his freedom. But, said I, suppose you succeed in running off a few slaves, and thus impress the Virginia slaveholders with a sense of insecurity in their slaves further south. That, he said, will be what I want first to do. Then I would follow them up. If we could drive slavery out of one county, it would be a great gain. It would weaken the system throughout the state. But they would employ bloodhounds to hunt you out of the mountains. That they might attempt, said he, but the chances are we should whip them, and when we should have whipped one squad, they would be careful how they pursued. But you might be surrounded and cut off from your provisions or means of subsistence. He thought that this could not be done so that they could not cut their way out. But even if the worst came, he could but be killed, and he had no better use for his life than to lay it down in the cause of the slave. When I suggested that we might convert the slaveholders, he became much excited and said that could never be. He knew their proud hearts, and they would never be induced to give up their slaves until they felt a big stick about their heads. He observed that I might have noticed the simple manner in which he lived, adding that he had adopted this method in order to save money to carry out his purposes. This was said in no boastful tone, for he felt that he had delayed already too long, and had no room to boast either his zeal or his self-denial. Had some men made such display of rigid virtue, I would have rejected it as affected, false, and hypocritical. But in John Brown I felt it to be real as iron or granite. From this night, spent with John Brown in Springfield, Massachusetts, 1847, while I continued to write and speak against slavery, I became all the same less hopeful of its peaceful abolition. My utterances became more and more tinged by the color of this man's strong impressions. Tremendously impressed as was Douglas in mind and heart with John Brown and his plan, his reason was never convinced even up to the last. And naturally, because here two radically opposite characters saw slavery from opposite sides of the shield. Both hated it with all their strength, but one knew its physical degradation, its tremendous power, and the strong sympathies and interests that buttressed it the world over. The other felt its moral evil, and knowing simply that it was wrong, concluded that John Brown and God could overthrow it. That was all, a plain, straightforward path. But to the subtler, darker man, more worldly wise and less religious, the arm of the Lord was not revealed, while the evil of this world had seared his vitals. He uncovered himself, if not reverently, certainly respectfully, before the seer. He gave him much help and information. He turned almost imperceptibly, but surely, toward Brown's darker view of the blood sacrifice of slavery. But he could never quite believe that John Brown's tremendous plan was humanly possible. And this attitude of Douglas was, in various degrees and strides, the attitude of the leading Negroes of his day. They believed in John Brown, but not in his plan. They knew he was right, but they knew that for any failure in his project, they, the black men, would probably pay the cost. And the horror of that cost none knew as they. If John Brown was to carry out his idea as he had now definitely conceived it, he must first find the man who could help him. On this point, there seems to have been deliberation and development of plan, particularly as he consulted Douglas and the Negro leaders. His earlier scheme probably looked toward the use of Negro allies almost exclusively outside his own family. This was eminently fitting, but impractical, as Douglas and his fellows must have urged. White men could move where they would in the United States, but to introduce an armed band exclusively or mainly of Negroes from the North into the South was difficult, if not impossible. Nevertheless, some Negroes of the right type were needed, and to John Brown's mind, the Underground Railroad was bringing North the very material he required. It could not, however, be properly trained in cities whither it drifted, both for economic reasons and for self-protection. Brown therefore heard of Gerrit Smith's offer of August 1, 1846, with great interest. This wealthy leader of the New York Abolition Group took occasion at the celebration of the 12th anniversary of British emancipation to offer free Negroes 100,000 acres of his lands in the Adirondack region on easy terms. It was not a well-thought-out scheme. The climate was bleak for Negroes. The methods of culture then suitable were unknown to them, while the surveyor who laid out these farms cheated them as cheerily as though philanthropy had no concern with the project. The Gerrit Smith offer was not wholly a failure. It turned out some good Negro farmers, gave some of its best Negro citizens of today to northern New York, and trained a bishop of the British African Church. But it did far less than it might have done if better planned, and much, if not all, of its success was due to John Brown. He saw possibilities here both to shelter his family when he turned definitely to what was now his single object in life, and to train men to help him. He went to Gerrit Smith at Peterborough, New York, in April 1848, and said, "I am something of a pioneer. I grew up among the woods and wild Indians of Ohio, and am used to the climate and the way of life that your colony finds so trying. I will take one of your farms myself, clear it up and plant it, and show my colored neighbors how such work should be done. We'll give them work as I have occasion, look after them in all needful ways, and be a kind of father to them." His offer was gladly accepted, and he moved his family there the following year. It was a wild, lonely place. Thomas Wentworth Higginson wrote once, "The Notch seems beyond the world. North Elba and its half-dozen houses are beyond the Notch, and there is a wilder little mountain road which rises beyond North Elba. But the house we seek is not even on that road, but behind it and beyond it. You ride a mile or two, then take down a pair of bars. Beyond the bars, faith takes you across a half-cleared field, through the most difficult of wood paths, and after half a mile of forest, you come out upon a clearing. There is a little frame house, unpainted, set in a girdle of black stumps, and with all heaven about it for a wider girdle. On a high hillside, forests on north and west, the glorious line of the Adirondacks on the east, and on the south one slender road leading off to Westport, a road so straight that you could sight a United States Marshal for 5 miles. To his family, John Brown's word was usually not merely law, but wish. They went to North Elba cheerfully, and with full knowledge of the import of the change, for the father was frank. The daughter Ruth writes, "While we were living in Springfield, our house was plainly furnished, but very comfortably, all excepting the parlor. Mother and I had often expressed a wish that the parlor might be furnished too, and father encouraged us that it should be, but after he made up his mind to go to North Elba, he began to economize in many ways. One day he called us older ones to him and said, 'I want to plan with you a little, and I want you all to express your minds. I have a little money to spare, and now shall we use it to furnish the parlor, or spend it to buy clothing for the colored people who may need help in North Elba another year?' We all said, 'Save the money.'" It was no paradise, even for the enthusiast. Redpath says, it is too cold to raise corn there. They can scarcely, in the most favorable seasons, obtain a few ears for roasting. Stock must be wintered there nearly 6 months in every year. I was there on the 1st of November. The ground was snowy, and winter had apparently begun, and it would last till the middle of May. They never raise anything to sell off that farm, except sometimes a few fleeces. It was well, they said, if they raised their own provisions, and could spin their own wool for clothing. Meantime, the scattered, isolated eddies of the anti-slavery battles were swirling to one great current, and more, John Brown was becoming the man of one idea. Impatiently, he neglected his pressing wool business. Instead of keeping his eye on his critical London venture, he hastened across Europe, perfecting military observations. He returned to America in time to hear all the feverish discussion of the fugitive slave law and see its final passage. In November 1850, he writes his wife from Springfield, "It now seems that the fugitive slave law was to be the means of making more abolitionists than all the lectures we have had for years. It really looks as if God had his hand on this wickedness also. I, of course, keep encouraging my colored friends to trust in God and keep their powder dry. I did so today at Thanksgiving meeting publicly." His Springfield meetings led to the formation of the League of Gileadites, the first of his steps toward the armed organization of Negroes. 44 Negroes signed the following agreement. "As citizens of the United States of America, trusting in a just and merciful God, whose spirit and all-powerful aid we humbly implore, we will ever be true to the flag of our beloved country, always acting under it. We, whose names are hereunto affixed, do constitute ourselves a branch of the United States League of Gileadites, that we will provide ourselves at once with suitable implements, and will aid those who do not possess the means, if any such are disposed to join us. We invite every colored person whose heart is engaged in the performance of our business, whether male or female, old or young. The duty of the aged, infirm, and young members of the League shall be to give instant notice to all members in case of an attack upon any of our people. We agree to have no officers except a treasurer and secretary pro tempore, until after some trial of courage and talent of able-bodied members shall enable us to elect officers from those who shall have rendered the most important services. Nothing but wisdom and undaunted courage, efficiency, and general good conduct shall in any way influence us in electing officers." To this was added exhortation and advice by John Brown. "Nothing so charms the American people as personal bravery," he wrote. "Witness the case of Sankey, of everlasting memory, on board the Amistad. The trial for life of one bold and to some extent successful man for defending his rights in good earnest would arouse more sympathy throughout the nation than the accumulated wrongs and sufferings of more than 3 millions of our submissive colored population. We need not mention the Greeks struggling against the oppressive Turks, the Poles against Russia, nor the Hungarians against Austria and Russia combined, to prove this. No jury can be found in the northern states that would convict a man for defending his rights to the last extremity. This is well understood by Southern congressmen, who insist that the right of trial by jury should not be granted to the fugitive. Colored people have 10 times the number of fast friends among the whites than they suppose, and would have 10 times the number they have now were they but half as much in earnest to secure their dearest rights as they are to ape the follies and extravagances of their white neighbors, and to indulge in idle show, in ease and luxury. Just think of the money expended by individuals in your behalf for the last 20 years. Think of the number who have been mobbed and imprisoned on your account. Have any of you seen the brand at hand? Do you remember the names of Lovejoy and Tory?" He then gives definite advice as to procedure in case the arrest and the deportation of a fugitive slave were attempted. Should one of your number be arrested, you must collect together as quickly as possible so as to outnumber your adversaries, who are taking an active part against you. Let no able-bodied man appear on the ground unequipped or with his weapons exposed to view. Let that be understood beforehand. Your plans must be known only to yourself, and with the understanding that all traitors must die, wherever caught and proven to be guilty. Whosoever is fearful or afraid, let him return and depart early from Mount Gilead. Judges 7:3, Deuteronomy 20:8. Give all cowards an opportunity to show it on condition of holding their peace. Do not delay one moment after you are ready. You will lose all your resolution if you do. Let the first blow be the signal for all to engage, and when engaged, do not do your work in halves, but make clean work with your enemies, and be sure you meddle not with any others. By going about your business quietly, you will get the job disposed of before the number that an uproar would bring together can collect, and you will have the advantage of those who come out against you, for they will be wholly unprepared with either equipments or matured plans. All with them will be confusion and terror. Your enemies will be slow to attack you after you have done up the work nicely, and if they should, they will have to encounter your white friends as well as you, for you may safely calculate on a division of the whites, and may by that means get to an honorable parley. Be firm, determined, and cool, but let it be understood that you are not to be driven to desperation without making it an awful dear job to others as well as to you. Give them to know distinctly that those who live in wooden houses should not throw fire, and that you are just as able to suffer as your white neighbors. After effecting a rescue, if you are assailed, go into the houses of your most prominent and influential white friends with your wives, and that will effectually fasten upon them the suspicion of being connected with you, and will compel them to make a common cause with you, whether they would otherwise live up to their profession or not. This would leave them no choice in the matter. Some would doubtless prove themselves true of their own choice. Others would flinch. That would be taking them at their own words. You may make a tumult in the courtroom where a trial is going on by burning gunpowder freely in paper packages, but in such case the prisoner will need to take the hint at once and bestir himself, and so should his friends improve the opportunity for a general rush. A lasso might possibly be applied to a slave catcher for once with good effect. Hold on to your weapons, and never be persuaded to leave them, part with them, or have them far away from you. Stand by one another and by your friends, while a drop of blood remains, and be hanged if you must, but tell no tales out of school. Make no confession. Union is strength. Without some well-digested arrangements, nothing to any good purpose is likely to be done, let the demand be never so great. Witness the case of Hamlet and Long in New York, when there was no well-defined plan of operations or suitable preparation beforehand. The desired end may be effectually secured by the means proposed, namely, the enjoyment of our inalienable rights. There is evidence that this league did effective rescue work, as did other groups of Negroes in Boston, Philadelphia, Albany, New York, and elsewhere. In this service, the Negroes could not act alone. It would have meant mob violence on purely racial lines. But given a few determined white men to join in, they could and did bear the brunt of the fighting. John Brown himself was active in such rescue work. He helped in the release of Jerry in Syracuse, and writes in 1851 from Springfield, "Since the sending off to slavery of Long from New York, I have improved my leisure hours quite busily with colored people here, in advising them how to act, and in giving them all the encouragement in my power. They very much need encouragement and advice, and some of them are so alarmed that they tell me they cannot sleep on account of either themselves or their wives and children. I can only say I think I have been able to do something to revive their broken spirits. I want all my family to imagine themselves in the same dreadful condition. my only spare time being taken up, often till late hours at night, in the way I speak of, has prevented me from the gloomy homesick feelings which had before so much oppressed me. Not that I forget my family at all. His hateful lawsuits hung like a weight about John Brown's neck, and a feverish impatience was seizing him. Father did not close up his wool business in Springfield when he went to North Elba, and had to make several journeys back and forth in 1849 and 50. He was at Springfield in January 1851, soon after the passage of the Fugitive Slave Law, and went around among his colored friends there, who had been fugitives, urging them to resist the law, no matter by what authority it should be enforced. He told them to arm themselves with revolvers, men and women, and not to be taken alive. When he got to North Elba, he told us about the Fugitive Slave Law, and bade us resist any attempt that might be made to take any fugitive from our town, regardless of fine or imprisonment. Our faithful boy Cyrus was one of that class, and our feelings were so aroused that we would all have defended him, though the women folks had resorted to hot water. Father at this time said, "Their cup of iniquity is almost full." One evening, as I was singing "The Slave Father Mourning for His Children," containing these words, "You're gone from me, my gentle ones, with all your shouts of mirth. A silence is within my walls, a darkness round my hearth." Father got up and walked the floor, and before I could finish the song, he said, "Oh, Ruth, don't sing any more. It is too sad." At the same time, his thrifty, careful attention to minutiae did not desert him. He keeps his eye on North Elba even after his wife and part of the family returned to Akron, and writes, "The colored families appear to be doing well, and to feel encouraged. They all send much love to you. They have constant preaching on the Sabbath, and intelligence, morality, and religion appear to be all on the advance." His daughter says he did not lose interest in the colored people of North Elba, and grieved over the sad fate of one of them, Mr. Henderson, who was lost in the woods in the winter of 1852, and perished with the cold. Mr. Henderson was an intelligent and good man, and was very industrious, and Father thought much of him. Once we find him saying, "If you find it difficult for you to pay for Douglas's paper, I wish you would let me know I took liberty in ordering it continued. You have been very kind in helping me, and I do not mean to make myself a burden." And again he writes, "I am much rejoiced at the news of a religious kind in Ruth's letter, and would be still more rejoiced to learn that all the sects who bear the Christian name would have no more to do with that mother of all abominations, man-stealing." And the sects were thinking. All men were thinking. A great unrest was on the land. It was not merely moral leadership from above, it was the push of physical and mental pain from beneath. Not simply the cry of the abolitionist, but the upstretching of the slave. The vision of the damned was stirring the Western world, and stirring black men as well as white. Something was forcing the issue, call it what you will, the spirit of God or the spell of Africa. It came like some great grinding groundswell, vast, indefinite, immeasurable, but mighty, like the dark, low whispering of some infinite disembodied voice, a riddle of the Sphinx. It tore men's souls and wrecked their faith. Women cried out, as cried once that tall black sibyl, Sojourner Truth. "Frederick, is God dead?" "No," thundered the Douglas, towering above his Salem audience. "No, and because God is not dead, slavery can only end in blood." End of chapter 5.